Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The Canadian Centre for Behavioural Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge is home to a group of scientists who are studying brain injury and different factors that lead to better recovery. Dr. Nicole Sharon and PhD student Marie Monfils are two of those researchers. One is looking at damage to the frontal cortex and the other to the motor cortex. And John Doan is a kinesiologist developing a computer model that could improve treatment for people suffering from Parkinson's disease. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. At the University of Lethbridge, you'll find one of the most important institutes for helping us better understand the way our brains work, and that's the Canadian Centre for Behavioural Neuroscience. One of the researchers looking at what happens when the brain is damaged is Dr. Nicole Sharon, a postdoctoral fellow at the centre.
Well, what I'm doing with lesions is a little bit special. I'm looking at lesions in baby rats. So my models concern models of damage, brain damage during infancy. And what we do is we actually suck out little bits of the brain with a pipette and a vacuum pump to simulate removal of the brain during neurosurgery.
And are you doing it on both sides of the brain or just one side? How does that work?
Well, what my supervisor has done for many years is looked at how rats perform behaviorally after he removes both sides of the brain in one particular area, most usually the frontal cortex. But what I'm doing is looking at how rats behave after you remove only one side of the brain. And right now my studies are confined to the frontal cortex as well. And we want to know if rats behave even better when only one side of the brain is removed, or perhaps even worse, depending on the task.
Well, what's happening on both sides of the brain?
Well, in the human brain, we have two hemispheres, the left and the right, and there are complementary areas on each side. So when you remove both sides, you usually remove an entire area and quite often the function that that area subserves. But because the human brain is lateralized, and in pretty much all mammalian species, they have two sides to the brain, if you only remove one side, you might see that function stays in the side that's undamaged. However, as the brain is developing, when you damage it, it can reorganize in a way which can be favorable or unfavorable. So this remaining part of the brain might actually not be working properly.
What are you finding?
Well, what I'm finding is that, surprisingly, when you remove one half of the frontal cortex during infancy, the rats develop actually a bilateral motor problem. And by that I mean a problem in both their paws when they do fine motor tasks like reaching for small little bits of food. Rats use their paws like we use our hands. They have digits which move and grasp, and they're very adept at grabbing little bits of things and bringing it up to their mouth to eat. And interestingly, the motor system is crossed, so the left half of the brain controls the right side of the body, and the right half of the brain controls the left side of the body. If you remove or damage the left half of the brain, you would expect to see some sort of behavioral problem on the right side of the body. And what I'm seeing is when I damage the frontal cortex, which isn't even the motor cortex, it's just right beside the motor cortex, I'm seeing a problem in my rats with both of their paws.
This is unexpected. So then why do you think that's happening?
Well, it could be that, in fact, the other side of the brain has reorganized to compensate for the damaged side, and that this has actually somehow created a problem in the motor cortex, perhaps by cell axons which aren't supposed to be there growing in, or connections not being pruned away during development. I'm doing some studies with what we call retrograde tracers. They're basically fluorescent dyes that we inject into particular areas of the brain, and they get taken up by axons and transported back to the cell body so we can see what areas of the brain connect to what other areas of the brain. And what I'm finding is that when rats have this unilateral frontal lesion, their corticostriatal system, so the axons that project from the cortex into the subcortical motor systems, are no longer crossed like they should be. So the left half of the brain is not necessarily exerting the same amount of control over the right half of the body that it would be in a normal rat.
What's that telling you?
Well, what it's telling us is that the brain has the capacity to reorganize when you damage it during infancy, and that this reorganization isn't always beneficial. It can be maladaptive. What we want to do is then try and institute some treatments like tactile stimulation, which raises growth factors in the brain, or perhaps something like a vitamin supplement or something along these lines, which is also proven beneficial after strokes, I believe, and see whether or not we can not necessarily prevent reorganization, but promote adaptive reorganization of the brain.
Now, you're doing this at a very early stage in a rat's life. Why does it have to be at the early stage? Is it something that you could use later on?
Well, actually, there's something called, in my field, the Kennard principle, first theorized by Margaret Kennard. She stated in her studies on monkey motor cortex damage that when you do motor cortex damage in a monkey at a very young age, the monkey does not seem to have the same sorts of motor problems that an adult monkey would have had if you did the lesion in the adult. And what we're finding is the same thing. If you do lesions in adult rats, you usually see pretty poor recovery after the lesion compared to when you do the lesions in babies. And the idea is not only do we have a model of brain damage in infants, in humans, but we're also looking at what the anatomical substrates are that are promoting recovery of function. So we look at things like reorganization of the axons. We look at the morphology of the cells and their dendrites. And we're trying to take advantage of spontaneous recovery, see what anatomical correlates are underlying spontaneous recovery, with the idea that we might be able to facilitate this perhaps in adult rats, once we know what's underlying recovery in the infants, and we're taking advantage, as I said, of the fact that this recovery occurs spontaneously depending on the age at which you do the lesion.
There's an awful lot of work in and around this area in the lab where you are under Dr. Kolb. How does your part fit into the bigger picture?
Well, I fit into the bigger picture partially because I came from a lab wherein I was doing lesions on baby rats, but I was doing neurochemical lesions and looking at how different neurochemicals affect the development of the cortex and the morphology of cortical cells. And one thing that we've seen is that doing damage to particular neurotransmitter systems can sometimes block recovery in these rats. So several people are looking at this problem developmentally, and we're all taking a little bit of a different tack. For example, some students are looking at different areas of the cortex rather than frontal. They're looking at motor. Instead of looking at a bilateral lesion, I'm looking at a unilateral lesion, just to see whether or not we see similarities across brain areas, across types of lesions, because not every lesion is the same. You wouldn't necessarily expect to see always a similar type of recovery if you give a stroke than if you remove part of the brain, because in one instance you're actually taking brain away, and in another instance you're actually damaging existing brain and leaving it in there, and that can sometimes be much more detrimental.
Can you at this point see some adaptation of what you're doing to ultimate treatment for human beings?
Absolutely. There are a lot of therapeutic approaches that we take in the lab to look at recovery of function. So one is tactile stimulation. It involves simply taking a soft paintbrush and stroking the baby rats after they've had a lesion. And we find that they recover much better than they would have if they had no tactile stimulation at all. And so The idea being that in babies who have brain damage, we should make sure that they get as much tactile stimulation as possible to try and promote recovery of function in these kids. So certainly I think that a lot of the work that we've done here could be implemented, if not today, then, you know, very shortly down the road.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Nicole Sharon, a postdoctoral fellow at the Canadian Center for Behavioral Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge. Another young scientist researching brain injury at the Canadian Center for Behavioral Neuroscience in Lethbridge is Marie Monfils. Marie is a PhD student studying under Dr. Jeff Klein and Dr. Brian Kolb. Her work focuses on the motor cortex.
Basically, I'm exploring recovery from early brain injury, so injury inflicted really early on in development, and trying to see if the application of a growth factor can improve the outcome, both the functional and the anatomical outcome following early brain injury.
Now, you're working with young rats on this. What are you actually looking at with the rats?
Well, in the young rats that I study, I actually inflict injury to the motor cortex, and then I give them the growth factor, and I let them grow until adulthood. And then I assess them on a behavioral task, which is specific to the motor cortex. It's the skilled reaching task paradigm that we use. And after that, I can actually sacrifice them and look at their brains and trying to correlate structure to function to see if the rats performed better following the application of the treatment, in this case the growth factor. I can try to establish what could actually subserve this recovery of function in the structure of the brain. Looking at synapses, or looking at the physiology of the cells within the brain regions that are involved in that behavior, essentially.
When you say growth factor, what do you mean?
Well, some previous research that was done in the Kolb lab suggested that there's a certain period in development where rats recover better from brain injury. And this period was also found to be correlated with an increase in a certain growth factor. So I tried to use this growth factor, which is actually a protein, to improve function following injury to a different brain area that wasn't found to actually show this increase in the same growth factor. So essentially it was capitalizing on some prior research and using this to apply the growth factor exogenously to see if it would improve recovery of function following motor cortex damage.
Do you test them all along the way to see what's happening at different ages or stages of development?
I could, and I chose not to, because testing the rats on behavioral tests actually has an effect on her brain. So it'll have an effect on the anatomy. It'll have an effect on the function eventually. And so for my preliminary work, I wanted to see just simply if the growth factor itself could have an effect on the behavior, and if that growth factor could also have an effect on the anatomy of the brain. But that's a really good question. That's something that we should do in the future, try to assess the animals at different time points and also see if this could serve in the form of rehabilitation in trying to help the rats as well.
What have you found out so far?
I found that the growth factor was actually quite effective following damage to the motor cortex inflicted at postnatal day 10 in the rats. And the rats recovered essentially on the skilled reaching task. So one of the things I did was that we did lesions at postnatal day 10 in infant rats. So we removed some tissue there, and we applied the growth factor. And what we discovered was that the rats that received the growth factor performed better on a behavioral task once they reached adulthood than the rats that didn't receive the growth factor. Now, upon closer examination, I found that the rats that received the growth factor actually had some cells filling the lesion cavity that we had originally removed. And so one of my questions after this was, well, could these cells actually subserve the functional recovery that I saw? So what I did is I used a technique called intracortical microstimulation, which we use in Jeff Klein's lab, which entails basically stimulating a brain area to see if you can elicit movement. And we could actually elicit some movements from this region. And I used a different technique also in conjunction with this, just to I guess, enhance the experiment in collaboration with Karim Fouad from the University of Alberta, and found that not only could I elicit movements, but in some cases where I couldn't see the movements being elicited, I could actually record some EMGs from the muscles in those rats, suggesting that perhaps that area was actually responsible for subserving the recovery that we could see in those animals.
Well, with those cells being present there, does that mean that it's actually regenerating?
Well, that's a very good question. And we're doing some studies right now to assess this. I mean, one question that comes to mind is, where do those cells come from? And so currently we're doing some immunotesting to see, actually, to localize where those cells might be coming from and to see if they're proliferating to the site of injury. Because that's, I mean, that would be really powerful if we could actually harness those cells and send them to the appropriate target to enhance recovery of function. That would be really good.
Does it matter at what age and which part of the brain that these injuries happen?
It seems to matter. There's some research that was done in the past 25 years in the Kolb lab suggesting that rats recover far better from a lesion inflicted at postnatal day 10 than they do from a lesion inflicted at postnatal day 3, for example. And this is correlated with also a recovery in the anatomy. The other thing is, if you inflict a lesion at postnatal day 10, you have a spontaneous recovery if you inflict it in the medial prefrontal cortex. But if you do the same kind of lesion in the motor cortex at postnatal day 10, you don't get that same recovery unless you apply the exogenous growth factor, for example. So there is, I guess, the bottom line is that there's an effect of time, so the timing is important, but also the area is important that you choose to damage.
Where do you go from here on this?
I guess what I'll try to do is take a step back and take a closer look at the rules that and the patterns that I can see emerging from those studies, just the patterns that we can see emerging in terms of the kind of recovery of function we see, the different brain areas that actually subserve this recovery of function, and try to apply this to possibly generate better treatments for children with brain disorders and so forth.
What do you see as being a critical period or that time window that's so important?
In terms of rats, we know that it's around 10 days of age, as opposed to earlier on. In terms of a human child, I guess we can suppose that that period would be between 4 to 8 months of age. But I'm not sure that it's been firmly established, and more research needs to be done, essentially, to address this with more precision.
What's happening in the brain at that stage?
The critical period seems to be related to mostly an increase in synapse formation. The period at which the brain seems to be the most vulnerable seems to occur almost immediately after neurogenesis, so after the neurons have just started to form and migrate.
Now, the work that you're doing is just a small part of everything else that goes on in the behavioral neuroscience department here. Where does your work fit in?
That's a really good question. I think the center specializes or is really good at doing one specific thing, which is to correlate behavior to brain structure. Basically, there's this fundamental concept in neuroscience that structure underlies function. And this might seem really simple to say, but if you damage the brain in some way, then by default, there should be an effect on behavior. But it's not that simple, because sometimes you damage the brain in some way and you look at a certain behavior and you don't see any effect on the behavior. Well, the problem is that maybe you're not looking carefully enough and you don't have a measure that's sensitive enough to assess the behavior. And I think this center specializes in actually looking at behavior in a very, very exquisite way. And I think that's part of what the Kolb lab does, correlates behavior to brain function.
Thank you very much, Marie.
Thank you.
That was Marie Monfi, a PhD student studying at the Canadian Center for Behavioral Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge. The Canadian Centre for Behavioral Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge is world-renowned for its work on Parkinson's disease. John Doan is a PhD student who is combining his training in kinesiology with his interest in Parkinson's. His objective is to develop a computer model that could improve the treatment for Parkinson's patients.
Parkinson's is a movement disorder. It comes from degeneration of dopamine-producing neurons in the brain, and this degeneration leads to problems in starting movements, sequencing movements, and just structuring activities and movement patterns in the same way that a healthy adult would.
With your research, what is the question that you're addressing?
Well, our real interest is in looking at not so much what Parkinson's patients can't do, but what they can do. It's amazing the number of activities patients can still make. So we look at putting our Parkinson's patients into activities of daily living like standing, walking, crossing obstacles, and reaching, looking at how they're making those movements, and then increasing the difficulty of those movements, either by making the reaches towards a delicate object or making the walking through a confined area, and then looking at how those constraints change the way they make their movements.
What is it that you're finding so far?
What we find is that Parkinson's patients are often using entirely new movement patterns or movement strategies to accomplish these complicated or constrained movements. So when a patient's reaching for a glass that's full of water, they'll use a movement that's remarkably different than what they do for reaches towards a glass that has no water in it, unlike a healthy adult control who would use the same reach whether the glass is empty or full.
Well, why would they do that? Why would they have to do something completely different in their brain?
Well, our suggestion is that patients are actually using their attentional resources and cortical volume in their brain to shape and structure these movements, sort of a compensation from the automatic processes that a healthy adult would use to make their movements. But when we can increase the interference between paying attention to the movement and paying attention to the constraints of the movement, such as reaching from a standing platform, we start to see a little bit of interference, and we take away from the resources they can use to control the movement, leading to certain deficits and certain protective strategies to make sure they don't have an upset condition.
Well, you can observe all of that from just watching the person, but how do you know what's really going on in the brain?
Well, at our level, we don't know what's going on in the brain. We're making an inference here, and we're basing that inference on quantitative observations of how they're making that movement. So we can use biomechanical motion analysis systems, computer software, as well as looking at their muscle activities to understand really how they're structuring, shaping, and making that movement in precise detail.
I understand that you're modeling this. How are you going about modeling? What does that include?
The modeling for us is just it's an aspect of looking at a group of patients and looking at the commonalities on how they're making these movements. So is everyone using the same acceleration and deceleration profile to move their arm? Is everyone using the same pattern and strategy to step over top of an obstacle? And then we combine this into a model that lets us know what this group as a population would be doing.
Would you be putting that on a computer program?
We do. We use some prepackaged computer software to do our motion analysis and look at some of our simple measures. We also do a lot of programming in-house in our own lab to help to understand exactly what these movements look like and how they're structured.
Looking down the road, what application do you see this having once you've done all this work? How might it be used?
I think it has two really pertinent applications. One is looking at current management strategies for Parkinson's disease. So we also test the patients on and off their medication, and we look at specifically what sort of movements that the medication re-enables, what it allows patients to re-automate or perform more automatically. We also work with some researchers up at Foothills Hospital in Calgary who are performing some new deep brain stimulation surgery with Parkinson's patients. And again, we can test these patients with their stimulators turned on and with the stimulators turned off, so we can tell specifically what the stimulator has reestablished or re-automated for that patient. I think the other aspect that we can get to in the future is looking at different therapy strategies for the Parkinson's patient. So understanding that reaching from a standing position to a delicate object, such as reaching from standing on a chair into a high cupboard in your kitchen, is a situation that causes specific problems for Parkinson's patients, where they may have a fall or an upset condition, which is very common among Parkinson's. Understanding that's the problem, we can start to tailor therapies to helping patients deal with those situations, understand their limitations in those situations, and make safer movements.
At the time that I'm speaking with you, it's just after the passing of Pope John Paul, and one of the things that I found surprising is to find out that he had Parkinson's. Do you see this as being actually quite a wide-ranging disease?
It is a very wide-ranging disease, and I think if we look at some of our classic celebrity examples like a Michael J. Fox or a Muhammad Ali or the Pope, as you've mentioned, we know it can strike all areas of life as well as all along the continuum of adulthood. Michael J. Fox's Parkinsonism first really manifested or turned into symptoms when he was just over 30. So it's turning into a very widespread disease. Over 100,000 Canadians currently have Parkinson's disease, and I think it's a number that unfortunately is on its way up.
With the research that you're doing and the things you're finding out about movement, what sort of hope does this give for people in the future who might come down with this disease?
I think from our end, the biggest hope would be in different and more effective forms of therapy and management for their Parkinson's disease. After people have been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease or have seen evidence of Parkinson's disease in their movement, it's often a very quick spiral from being an active adult to a real period of inactivity. The combination of having problems with your movements in real-world activities. So an example would be freezing when you come to the edge of a sidewalk, inability to walk through a crowded mall. These sort of movement deficits often force people to stay at home, and it leads to a real inactivity spiral, which eventually can lead to greater problems such as loss of independence. I think our work can help people understand where they may have movement deficits and can also help to generate strategies to overcome those movement deficits. Could be a function of looking at moving through a complicated situation like a revolving door. When a Parkinson's patient gets to this revolving door, they may need to take some time and say, okay, I know I need to put my arm out, push that door, get it started, and step in. And if they can take some time up front, plan their movements, and then start the movements, that may make them more successful.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
That was John Doan, a PhD student at the University of Lethbridge. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, the Alberta Conservation Association, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Alberta Innovation and Science, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.